It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, roller derby is traditionally a women's sport, but men are also starting teams. We'll find out what it's like to be part of a male roller derby team.
First, we're talking about the official kickoff of the 2016 presidential campaign. The first high-profile candidate has thrown his hat into the ring, Texas Senator Ted Cruz. The conservative senator made his announcement this morning at Liberty University in Virginia.
Political junkie Ken Rudin is with us now to talk about this news and how the rest of the field is shaping up for 2016. Ken Rudin is host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, a nationally syndicated weekly radio program. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Veronica, thank you so much.
So at midnight on Monday, Ted Cruz announced his candidacy and released a couple of ads along with that. Let's listen to a little bit here.
I believe in America and her people, and I believe we can stand up and restore our promise. It's going to take a new generation of courageous conservatives to help make America great again. And I'm ready to stand with you to lead the fight.
Ted Cruz, they're coming out of the gate with that first official ad, and he made that announcement at Liberty University, founded by fundamentalist Jerry Falwell. Is Cruz getting out there early with a play for the conservative Christian vote, giving this place where he announced?
Well, I mean, what he's doing basically is that he has not been part of the conversation the last couple of weeks. Basically, it's been Jeb Bush, the so-called establishment choice, and perhaps Scott Walker, the governor of some Midwestern state, who's also becoming the alternative to Jeb Bush. And there are other conservatives out there, the Rand Pauls and the Marco Rubios and the Bobby Jindals and, of course, Ted Cruz and others, who say, wait, don't forget us. I mean, we're also interested. Ted Cruz is more interesting, I think, than many, is because unlike others in the Republican Party, he feels that compromise is a four-letter word, just as Bush may be a four-letter word to him as well. And he feels that the way to get the nomination, the way to win back the White House after 8 years of the Democrats in control, is by being a non-compromising, tell like it is, staying true to conservative principles, Republican. And that's what Ted Cruz represents.
Right. And he said that if you want a Hillary to win, then you should nominate a moderate Republican. So why not instead go for someone like me who has a better chance to defeat Hillary, according to Ted Cruz? Is there something to that logic?
Well, sure there is. I mean, a lot of people are saying that Jeb Bush is Me Too-ism, just like, you know, I mean, we heard this about a lot of Republicans in the past, that they're Republican light, they're Republican in name only, the rhinos we used to hear a lot about. And of course, Ted Cruz also knows that there are a lot of people yapping at Jeb Bush is right, while at the same time Jeb Bush is raising a ton of money, not only in Texas, but also from Bush donors who have been giving at least to his father in 1979 and 1980 when George H.W. Bush first ran for president. So there's a lot of Bush money there. There's establishment money out there. There's the Wall Street business community that gets very nervous when you have somebody very conservative like Ted Cruz. And so Cruz knows that if the argument, if the dialogue, if the conversation is really about Jeb Bush and the non-Jeb Bush. We used to hear that a lot about Hillary, too, the Hillary and the non-Hillary candidates. Ted Cruz wants to be the non-Jeb Bush candidate, and that's why he's the first one to officially announce.
Right, he's the first one out there, and does that, besides, you know, introducing himself back into the center of the conversation right now, does that also give that first candidate any kind of an edge?
It does in perhaps today and tomorrow and the next couple of days. And then, of course, on April 7th, when Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, is expected to announce his candidacy, then it'll be his turn in the sun. So, I mean, right now, Ted Cruz is really saying that, look, he can read the polls as well as anybody. And, of course, we're still talking about 10 months before Iowa and New Hampshire. So a lot can happen. A lot will happen. But he did see the CNN poll this week that showed Ted Cruz with 4% of the polls among all the, you know, like the Republicans. Now, Jeb Bush is not running away with anything. He got 16%, so there's no such thing as a front runner. But for him to break out of the pack, for Ted Cruz to break out of the pack, he picked a very good locale, Liberty University, with 10,000 students. Now, of course, it was compulsory attendance because it was a convocation this morning, and so everybody had to attend. And of course, if you look very closely, a lot of people in the stands were wearing Rand Paul T-shirts. That wasn't that shown that close. But the point is, it was a big crowd. It was a raucous crowd. And just like his father, who was a pastor himself, Ted Cruz has this evangelical way of getting crowds on his feet, walking up and down the stage and motioning, talking about God and faith. And he could do it as well as anybody. He's a good orator. He gets the crowd excited, but he's not the most popular guy in town. And usually, you know, if you have as many enemies in your own party as you have in the other party, that's not good for your chances for winning the nomination.
Well, now that Ted Cruz is out there, is this, in essence, you know, the first domino to tip, and now other people might be forced off their starting blocks a little bit sooner?
Well, it's interesting that Ted Cruz eschewed the obligatory exploratory committee thing, which is basically a farce anyway. I mean, everybody's exploring. They're not sure. They go on listening tours, and then ultimately they do what they were planning to do all along, announce. But it will accelerate the process, absolutely. As they say, Rand Paul is likely to announce on April 7th. Scott Walker is not talking about if I run. He's talking about when I run. So there are others. Rick Perry's talking about it. Chris Christie is looking at a date. Marco Rubio has to decide whether he's going to run for the Senate or for president, because he can't do both in Florida. And so you have a lot of other people hoping to, you know, become relevant. Again, as I say, this is good news for Ted Cruz in that he will hog the headlines, as he's done all day today and probably will do the next couple of days. But that ends when the next candidate jumps into the race.
We're talking right now to political junkie Ken Rudin about presidential politics and who might throw their hat into the ring for 2016, along with Ted Cruz, who announced last night at midnight. And for those candidates who are definitely going to run, it looks like Scott Walker in that pack, why wait? Why sit on it at this point?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think anybody was planning to sit. I think everybody was. It got accelerated once when Mitt Romney said he wouldn't run, and two, Jeb Bush announced sooner than most people thought that he would be seriously exploring a candidacy. I mean, of course, Hillary Clinton. Everybody knows Hillary Clinton. She could announce in April. She could probably announce in 2017, for all we're concerned, and still run in 2016. I mean, everybody knows who she is. But with so many Republicans trying to compete for the non Jeb Bush wing of the party and the support of that part of the party, earlier it makes much more sense than later, especially because you're going to need tens and tens of millions of dollars to be relevant. There are so many candidates, it's going to be so expensive, and it's going to be very compressed in the beginning. You have Iowa, you have New Hampshire, you have South Carolina, you have the early states, and if you don't have a ton of money, and you need a ton of money to not only buy airtime, but also to build organization, build up a campaign staff, and we keep thinking, well, 2016 is a long way away, but we're talking about February 1st, which is just a little over 10 months from now. It's really Iowa and New Hampshire just around the corner.
So to you, this doesn't seem too early.
No, look, I would do it for 4 years nonstop if it was up to me, because I live and breathe this stuff. And I don't think people outside of Iowa and New Hampshire live and breathe this stuff. But if you're going to win the nomination, obviously you have to raise the money and you have to be up there early. And especially when, you know, unlike 2012, where you had an incumbent president running for re-election, that's always difficult to defeat a sitting president. You have an open presidency in 2016. You have Hillary Clinton, who, as strong as she is among Democrats, and she is very strong among Democrats. She is a delicious target for Republicans, and I mean, they're almost chomping at the bit to take her on. But of course, as we've learned with Barack Obama in 2008, be careful what you wish for.
Well, let's focus now on Wisconsin. Governor Scott Walker has been discussed recently as a presidential favorite. He's been, I think you called him, in fact, the flavor of the month right now. How do you imagine that he would fare as a presidential candidate in 2016?
I think one of the reasons the Ted Cruz's and the Rand Paul's and perhaps Marco Rubio are accelerating their decision-making process is because of the surprising strength that Scott Walker has shown. First of all, we saw that not only during his election in 2010, but the recall in 2012 and then the re-election in 2014, he beat back the labor. He won in a blue state. He got a national conservative following, which, of course, is accompanied by national conservative money. So, you know, I've been talking to a lot of political Republican types around the country who said that it seems like Walker is surprising himself because he's doing exactly what needs to be done. He's not scaring away the establishment, which Ted Cruz often can do, and he's not certainly not alienating conservatives, because he's been a conservative from day one, and he proved a very conservative record in Wisconsin. So the feeling is that Scott Walker not only is a flavor of the month, but is somebody that Jeb Bush probably has to watch out the most, because he has good relationships with both wings of the party and is not seen as an ideologue, even though he is very, very conservative.
Is there any chance that it's maybe too soon for a potential candidate like Governor Walker to peak, that he could hit the crest too early and then interest will die off later on? It can get hard to sustain.
Well, there's something to be said about that. We saw 4 years ago, Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, was getting very good early reviews. I mean, he was doing very, very well in 2011. People were impressed with his campaign organization, with his fundraising. And then, of course, he had a run in the this fake event called the Iowa Straw Poll, which is really nothing more than a beauty contest where people get bussed in from around the country to support the candidate. And it's not scientific, but Michelle Bachmann won that contest. And then we saw Michelle Bachmann in August of 2011 saying, well, maybe she's the front runner. And, of course, a few months later in the Iowa caucus, she finished last. So there is the possibility of peaking too soon. But the fact is, if you could keep raising the money, if you keep becoming the center of attention, as we've seen in many Republican events around the country, we saw it with CPAC in Washington. We saw it with the Iowa Freedom Forum in Des Moines a few weeks ago. Scott Walker is still getting audiences on his feet. And as long as he keeps raising money and that keeps happening, he's not going to disappear anytime soon. But, of course, he does, as a first-time national candidate, he could make a gaffe. You know, the media love to look for gaffes and mistakes that candidates make, and Scott Walker knows that. Remember when Rudy Giuliani wondered if President Obama loved America or not, all the media went to Scott Walker and said, well, how do you feel about that? He has to be aware that, you know, he may be not only the flavor of the month, but he could be the target of the month, and he has to run a very careful campaign.
Well, it's about to get interesting. Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
Veronica, thank you.
That was Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, a nationally syndicated weekly radio program. He was with us to talk about the first high-profile candidate to announce a run for president in 2016, Ted Cruz.
Flat track roller derby has become a phenomenon in recent years. Invented in the 1920s, it evolved into a predominantly female sport, drawing women from a variety of backgrounds. For women on Madison's Mad Wreckin' Dolls, roller derby is more than just a rough and tumble sport. It's a supportive and accepting family of friends.
The first thing you need to know about roller derby is that anybody can derby. It's incredibly fast-paced.
Go, go, go. Like, let's go faster. Push yourself. Give it everything you've got.
You get to skate. You get to eventually hit people. You get to wear awesome outfits.
Gives you a chance to challenge yourself every day.
Kind of like football, but on wheels and in a circle.
Probably the best workout I've ever had.
It's pretty much the most fun you can have on skates and turning left. My name is Catherine. My roller derby name is Zoe Dash in Hell. Roller derby actually started as a competition.
Sully from Philly takes off, there she goes.
And it was more of a WWF kind of feel. You know, women would like wind themselves up and like hit like this.
Rock 'em, sock 'em action on a big bank track.
Also, more commonly now you'll see the flat track rather than the bank track.
My name is Ash. My roller derby name is Ash Hat.
The question people often ask me is, how do you play, or what's the point? You go around a track and there's two teams, five people on each team, four blockers and one jammer on each team. You win by your team scoring more points than the other team. You score points by your jammer getting past the members of the other team. So that's the point.
The Mad Wreckin' Dolls started in 2010. They started because there were people that were trying to get into the Mad Rolling Dolls, and they did not get drafted onto a team because, well, there's only a certain number of spots. They didn't want to stop skating. They wanted to keep training, and they just loved roller derby. They didn't want to give it up. So they got together in a group, and they said, how can we skate more? And they formed the Mad Wreckin' Dolls. We have all different kinds of people in this league.
I'm a large animal veterinarian.
I'm a French teacher.
I am an integration project manager.
I'm a science writer.
I'm a seamstress.
I work in government.
My name is Nikki. My derby name is Sugar Pony. It's given me a really good group of people and a support group that I didn't have previously because I'm quite new to Madison. Coming here and having a group of 120 people that are pretty much instantaneously friendly and good support for you was really good. And so it has given me confidence in the rest of my life.
My name is Jess. My name is Trueblood. I think roller derby has given me a stronger sense of who I am.
It's really nice to have a part of me that feels comfortable with what I'm doing and feels like I belong rather than feeling like everything is a struggle.
When you have 100 women who accept you for who you are and who support you and who help you push yourself, it just makes you happier with yourself. It gives you a sense of self and contentness. And also, you know, it's really great to be able to come to practice when you're a little irritated and just hit some girls.
Catch more stories about sports and games all this month on Wisconsin Life.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
As we've heard, derby is often seen as a women's sport, but increasingly men are joining in the fun, establishing their own teams. What is it like for guys to roll on what's been seen as women's turf?
Joining us now is Brian Johnson, also known as Brains, of the Milwaukee Blitzkrieg Men's Roller Derby League. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob and Veronica. Thanks for having me.
So, Brian, what got you into roller derby?
My girlfriend and I had split up for a little while, and when we got back together, started getting back together, she was trying out on the women's team and asked me if I wanted to come skate with her one day. And I met one of the guys who was starting on the team, and I went to one practice, and I was hooked.
Now, is this still seen as a new sport for men these days?
I don't think so much anymore. We haven't been around quite as long as the women, but we've been in Milwaukee since 2009. And so, you know, I think around the country there's some leagues that are older than ours, and for sure they work together with their women counterpart leagues very well.
Are there any, differences that you see between the women's league and the men's leagues?
I think the biggest difference is men are, we're not in the big spotlight, I think, as much as the women are. We play our gameplay just slightly different just because we're built a little bit different, but all the gameplay itself is the same for both leagues.
Now, how does derby, from your perspective, compare to all the other sports out there, all the other options men and women have to play?
Well, I think definitely for women, it's a chance for them to be in a full contact sport. I think that's just great. It's empowering for women, just as it is for men. I think men, though, have a few more options when it comes to playing full contact sports after you get out past the college level.
Now, this coming Saturday, sounds like your team is going to play against Madison's Quad Squad, which is a women's team, and this is one of the first men versus women's bouts in Wisconsin. How did that come about?
Well, basically, our interleague just put the word out that we'll play anybody. We'll come play men, we'll come play women. We've played some co-ed derby before. We've scrimmaged against Madison before in the past, but not in an open forum, and we thought it would just be great to do this. It'd be great fun.
And is it how is it different playing against a women's team versus your usual bout against a men's team?
The gameplay really isn't that much different. The biggest difference when you're playing strictly against a women's team is their teamwork can be much better than yours. they've been playing together longer in their leagues, and they can communicate to each other without even having to talk to each other. So communication's big on both sides, but having that amount of time together, their teamwork is very tight, and they will get right in front of you and shut you down.
Now, apparently there have been complaints anecdotally from women that some male players are behaving a little differently, that sometimes they're a little rude. Is there any validity to that?
Not in our league, for sure. We don't tolerate that kind of behavior. Our team, and one of the reasons that I got in a men's derby was because it wasn't, even though it's competitive, it's a much more positive environment than in some of the other sports I've played in the past. So you don't hear guys, if you miss a play, you don't hear them yelling and screaming or hollering at you because you did something wrong. They come in, they'll grab you up after the play and they'll go, well, come on, let's talk about this. What happened out here? They'll teach you. So it's much more of a positive learning environment.
So what's your hope for the future of the male side of roller derby?
For the male side, I think I'd really like to see us start to grow, get a lot larger, and be able to work more with the Women's League and just have roller derby as a sport advance. It's not so much just having the men's side advance as much as it is really getting more people involved in the sport. And I think everyone who's been in roller derby or has had a chance to be involved with any aspect of it, they know that it's a pretty good time.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, great. Thank you.
That was Brian Johnson of the Milwaukee Blitzkrieg Men's Roller Derby League. This Saturday, they host the Quad Squad, a Madison-based women's roller derby team in Cudahy. For tickets and info, check out blitzkrieg.com. That's BLITZDKRIEG.com.
Concussions and athletes were back in the headlines yet again last week when former UW football star Chris Borland announced his retirement from the NFL after 1 year in the pros, ultimately leaving millions of dollars on the table. He said the money wasn't worth the risks of long-term damage to his brain.
This comes in the midst of a big national discussion about head injuries, not just in pro football, but in a variety of sports, from peewee teams up through professional sports leagues.
Our next guest has been following this issue for a lot longer than most of us. Dr. Michael McCray is a professor of neurosurgery and director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's been researching the impact of concussions and brain trauma for over 20 years. He wrote the book Mild Traumatic Brain Injury and Post-Concussion Syndrome, released back in 2007. Dr. McCray, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me.
So Chris Borland, high-profile athlete, in working with athletes and coaches and parents yourself, do you encounter a lot of people asking similar questions about the risks of head injuries?
Well, certainly this topic is on the radar of more athletes, parents, coaches, sport-governing bodies than it was 20 years ago. I would not say that the tide has changed dramatically, but certainly we have more parents, for instance, contacting our clinic, asking about the safety of their son or daughter continuing to participate in contact or collision sports. It's quite a difference from years ago or a couple decades ago when we were trying to convince parents and athletes to perhaps take their foot off the pedal just for a few more days before they return to competition. And now we oftentimes have to counsel athletes and parents that it's indeed safe for them to return.
And as I mentioned, you've been at this issue longer than a lot of people. What first got your attention about sports-related brain injuries?
Well, in many ways, I was just lucky to be in the right place at the right time. I was a postgraduate fellow at the medical school at Northwestern in Chicago back in the mid-90s, and a couple of my mentors at that time, a neurologist and a neuropsychologist there, were both brain injury research experts. I was lucky enough to be involved in their clinical and laboratory work, At that time, the interest and study of sport-related concussion was very new to the horizon, a shift from studying civilians and emergency department patients, for instance, in car accidents and assaults and so forth. And for me, it was sort of the perfect combination of my long-term interest in sports, being a former athlete and enthusiast myself, and my interest in the neurosciences. And it was sort of just... It took on a life of its own then, and here we are more than 20 years later.
And what have we learned? What's a key thing we know now about these brain injuries that we didn't know two decades ago?
Well, 20 years ago, the fruit was hanging very low in that it was mostly a guessing game in terms of our scientific understanding of the injury and having very little evidence on which to base our clinical management decisions, whether it be in terms of diagnosis, treatment or ultimately return to play decisions in the management of athletes affected by concussion. Fast forward 20 years, and we have made enormous strides in our understanding of the acute clinical effects of this injury, how it presents, how long it typically takes an athlete to recover in terms of symptoms and cognitive ability, balance, and other functional capacities, and how we go about measuring recovery in order to make an evidence-based or more objective decision about an athlete's readiness to return to competition, rather than just solely relying on their self-report of their symptom recovery, which is obviously influenced by their motivations to return to play as soon as they can.
I'm talking to Dr. Michael McCray about concussions, head injuries, and sports. And Dr. McCray, let's get down to the sidelines, the decision-making. First, a question I bet you're asked a lot from parents. You know, should, given what we know now, should we let our kids play football, contact football? Should we let them do headers in soccer? What is your general advice to parents panicking over these questions right now?
Well, you've struck a chord there, I think, and used the right term. My general advice is to not panic. I, in fact, do encourage participation in all competitive sports at all levels when it's appropriate for your kid, based on their age, their ability, and their interest. I mean, the issues are perhaps more sociological than neurological when it comes to youth sports. And that's probably a discussion for a different day. But as it relates to, you know, the effects of concussion and the risks that surround it, there is no question that there is the potential for concussion in various contact and collision sports like football, soccer, lacrosse, ice hockey, wrestling, and so forth, or in basketball, as we witnessed in the NCAA tournament last night. But the fact of the matter is, a single uncomplicated sport-related concussion is followed by an uncomplicated course of recovery in a matter of days in the overwhelming majority of athletes. And when recovery extends much longer, there are usually other comorbidities or other factors that are contributing to that lengthier recovery. By no means am I suggesting that we go back to the old days where athletes commonly return to competition within the same game after a concussion. But I think an important message here for parents is that as long as your son or daughter is properly treated and managed after a concussion, their risk of any lingering long-term problems is nil, and they would be able to return to competition without problem.
But that seems to be the key that people in the medical community are talking about, the awareness of the signs of that first concussion and the willingness and maybe the rule setting to make sure that the player at whatever age doesn't get back into play until they've recovered sufficiently.
That's correct. So believe it or not, Rob, I think as recently as 2012, I was a participant on the Zurich panel in Switzerland, where we meet every 4 years to disseminate an international guideline for the assessment and management of sport-related concussion. And it wasn't until 2012 that our statement came out and definitively recommended that at all competitive levels, athletes should not return to competition on the same day as injury. Now, that might seem like a very intuitive recommendation to all your listeners and to most of us, frankly. But it took a long time to build consensus on even something as intuitive as that recommendation. If you look at some of the published data and other epidemiologic studies out there, we have literally in a matter of 5 to 10 years, we've taken the average time that athletes are withheld from competition after a concussion from 10 minutes to 2 weeks. And most of us would argue that as long as an athlete is given adequate time for recovery and not shuffled back onto the field of play too soon, that their risks really have been eliminated. And they're given adequate time for recovery, and they're able to return to their normal activities without risk.
Dr. Michael McCray from the Medical College of Wisconsin is with us. He's been studying the impact of concussions and brain injuries among athletes and others.
And we want to hear from you. You can call in with your questions and your experiences at 800-642-1234. If you're an athlete or the parent of a kid in sports, do you worry about the risk of concussion? Have you quit or avoided a sport because of brain worries? And if you're a coach, how does your league handle these concussion issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about head trauma, concussions, and athletes with Dr. Michael McCray from the Medical College of Wisconsin.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. As an athlete or the parent of kids in sports, how have you dealt with worries, concerns about head injuries, about concussions? Do you think we have enough precautions in place? And if you're a coach at any level, what's in place in your sport to protect against repeated head injury? And do you think it's enough? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got Paul starting us off now in Oregon. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me. Good topic, I appreciate it. It's timely for me as an assistant rugby coach here for high school athletes. I not only have to speak with them to this topic, but their parents. You may know or may not know that rugby-style tackling is different than football in that your head is supposed to be outside the body, so you're not risking any impact with a knee or striking the runner, and wrapping your arms around the runner as well. And I'm just curious if the doctor thinks that's enough. What's a good way to go about educating our parents about this?
Well, Paul, I can't speak specifically to rugby, but I can tell you there are commonalities between rugby and efforts being made at all competitive levels in football in an effort to revise and reform tackling technique and ultimately remove the head from the equation. One of the sayings is not first and not top, meaning don't lead with the head. And certainly don't have your head down when making a tackle in football. And you and other listeners may be aware that there are very broad-based efforts nationally right now in Pop Warner football, in USA football, with very elaborate tackling teaching methods and tutorials for coaches that are required, with the understanding that if we're going to make a change in the game to make it safer from the standpoint of tackling technique, this will likely be generational, that we can't start solely at the professional level where we're changing policy and so forth. This will have to be disseminated at the collegiate level, the high school level, and down into youth sports so that we create a new generation of athletes, football players or rugby players, whatever it might be, who really adhere to and adopt a safer tackling technique.
Thanks a lot for the call, Paul. We're talking to Dr. Michael McCray about sports and concussions and how to reduce the risk of head injuries. Dr. McCray, before we get back to our callers, one of the concerns, and came up with this Chris Borland case, is not just the tackling, but the initial collision between linemen in football and linebackers in some cases repeated again and again throughout the game. No one of them may be enough to get a concussion, but a series of smaller head traumas. Is that something you have a concern about that you think needs to be dealt with?
Well, certainly it's the topic of further research in terms of determining whether or not there is an association between repetitive head impact exposure and either short-term or long-term risk. In this case, I think you're referring to chronic traumatic encephalopathy, mm-hmm. which really is a separate discussion all of its own, reserved for an extremely small number of cases in the literature, and papers published as recently as a month ago suggesting that the number of those cases is much smaller than originally thought. But yes, one of the arms or aims of our research is to actually measure. We use accelerometers in all of our athletes that record and measure the frequency and magnitude of all head impacts that they sustain during practices and games over the course of multiple seasons, and to correlate whether or not that head impact exposure is a determinant of injury risk and recovery.
Back to our callers now. We've got Chris on the line in Ashland. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm a U-10 soccer coach up here in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, and I currently don't teach headers because of concerns of concussions and kind of following the philosophy of Brandy Chastain, who has a movement of, you know, avoiding headers or teaching headers because the possibility of collisions with head-to-head kind of contact or, you know, even head-to-ball because of early development of brains and, you know, not really teaching that until they get into high school. And I was just wondering, is there any kind of research that shows, you know, early concussions and, you know, what kind of effect that may have later on in life to support, you know, her kind of movement?
Chris, thanks for the call.
That's a great question, Coach, and a couple important points come to mind. To answer your direct question, no, the literature does not suggest that there is a link between heading exposure and short-term or long-term risk. However, you have touched on an important point that heading itself, not because of the impact of the head to the ball, heading itself is, in fact, one of the highest risk activities in competitive soccer because of not only concussions, but the rate of all forms of injury that occur during attempted headers. But more often than not, far more often than not, the mechanism is head-to-head, head-to-elbow, head-to-ground, head-to-knee, and other things that go wrong during attempted headers. And what that really, one of the policy developments that has helped drive by the American Pediatrics Association is a recommendation that players not participate in heading until, number one, they are physically capable of doing it in terms of strength and agility, and number two, they're adequately skilled at it as an injury prevention strategy.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your concerns there. One thing I always wonder about, and you alluded to this earlier, Dr. McCray, with wanting to keep athletes off the field after that initial concussion, athletes are there because they want to play. So is it hard to get someone to be willing to fess up that they have concussion-like symptoms, knowing that they're risking being out of the game they love for weeks?
It's fairly well known that for years, or forever perhaps, that many athletes choose not to come forward and report their injury. We have published a paper, maybe more than a decade ago, indicating that with a confidential survey of athletes, we figured that about half of the concussions that occurred were unreported. More recently, we replicated that work and wanted to know what has been the impact of educational campaigns, state legislation, and so forth, and there has been a major reduction in unreported concussions over the past decade. Athletes are better educated to recognize the signs and symptoms of injury. They're aware of the potential risks, and frankly, what we've also disseminated to athletes that is something that I refer to as the exchange rate, and that is that you are actually likely to lose less time from competition if you come forward and report your injury immediately, rather than choose to press forward, practice four or five more days, complicate your recovery, and then come forward. And that's what I refer to as an exchange rate that athletes, parents, and coaches can get their arms around.
Dr. McCray, that's a great bit of advice to leave us with. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I've been talking to Dr. Michael McCray. He's a professor of neurosurgery and director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin, talking about athletes, traumatic brain injury, and when to come out of the game.